Hi, I'm Michael Kramer, and welcome back to the What's Next in Corporate Real Estate podcast. Today, I'm thrilled to be talking to Philip Ross, who is founder and CEO of the Ungroup, Unwired and Unwork, and also Cordless Group, Cordless Consultants, and Cordless Resourcing. He has recently co-authored with Jeremy Marson a new book entitled Unworking, The Reinvention of the Modern Office, which we're going to dig into today in some detail. Philip, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Michael. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, good to see you again. So we were chatting about your book just before the summer, I guess, and you told me it was coming out. So here you are. Having read it, one of the things that jumped out at me was a reference to Burning Man. So the idea of Burning Man and real estate being connected fascinated me. So why don't we start there? Tell me a little bit about what you were thinking.
Well, Burning Man, as I'm sure most of you know, is this incredible event that takes place in the Nevada desert once a year. It just happened recently, actually, for the first time since lockdown. And really, why that's so interesting and relevant is that a city is created in the desert for a temporary few days of tens of thousands of people coming together. And you can therefore do master planning, city planning, at scale, at its best. You know, creating experiences for people who want to kind of come together and do something differently. And I think why Burning Man is fascinating, of course, is that it attracts the dot-com crowd. They even build a temporary airport to bring in the private jets of the dot-com entrepreneurs. So we're not talking about the kind of hippie trail. We're talking about people who want to kind of come together for experience. And really, that's what the office will be about. It will be people coming together for experience. So I think we can learn from how Burning Man both creates that out of nothing and then leaves no trace behind at the end.
Interesting. And we'll come back to that and that creation, because there's a lot to think about there. But one of the other things you talk about in the book is the Swan Syndrome, which I think everyone probably understands. But is it chaos below the waterline?
I think for many it is. You know, I think, you know, the classic graceful swan, you know, is kind of a little bit, I guess it's kind of a good analogy for how workplace and real estate has had to respond over the last two or three years. You know, looking that it's planned, in control, people know what they're trying to do, but below the water, panicking about really the response to the pandemic and lockdown.
And then the third sort of area within this I just wanted to touch on is you talk about, which I really like, the sentient workplace. Do you think we're finally connecting workplace with the environment kind of more Frank Lloyd Wright than Corbusier? Have we got over that hump and are we on the right track?
Well, I think the pandemic has put into stark contrast the impact of the environment we're in on our health and well-being. You know, we're now well aware of contagion, but the impact of air quality and other metrics. And I think, you know, we're hearing that parents are sending their school kids in America with handheld air quality sensors into schools. You know, half the real estate industry has no idea what the air quality is like in their buildings. And you're going to find that people know before they do. So I think sentience, you know, how we feel, will be absolutely fundamental. We've had interesting conversations. One client said to me recently, could people leave after a day at work in the office healthier than when they arrived?
Wow, there's a thought. And it kind of touches on something else I wanted to ask you about. Do you think as an industry we're equipped to deal with what we're now faced with? Because it seems to me from what you just said, something as simple as air quality, we're still very poor at, is what you're saying, be it in a school or an office.
Yeah.
There's lots of research that says how important it is, yet we don't seem to have picked up on it everywhere. So what do you think's been going on, or what is going on with our industry that we're missing out, let's say?
Well, I think, look, all of these things require technology, whether you're sensing the quality of the air or whether you're kind of helping to nudge somebody as to where they should go and how they should work. And there's two aspects of that. One is real-time sensing, and buildings have been very bad at that. We tend to still occupy dumb containers for work. You know, we all turn up, but there's no interaction, there's no intelligence. And that can change. We're well aware that in the City of London around us, Michael, you know, there are now intelligent buildings like 22 Bishopsgate, which are beginning to change the mould. But I think also the other big area is data, or data for our American listeners, because, look, buildings can generate huge amounts of data, not just about their performance, but about the performance of people who are inside them. And most real estate groups don't have anyone to analyse that data, even less so anyone to kind of influence or impact the implications of that data. So we need data analysis. We need a new function within real estate, which kind of begins to help shape use of space and experience in space based on data.
And you talk about in the book, and also it's been talked about a little bit, and actually had a podcast related to this, which is what can we learn from other parts of the property industry? So retail and hospitality being the two obvious ones. They seem to me have been very good at collecting data. So do you just want to talk a little bit about where that where that is impacting on the office world and how it's imposing perhaps some better habits on us, let's say?
Well, I think, look, everything should be challenged. I mean, at 22 Bishopsgate, to go back to that example, Stuart Lipton, who's one of our great developers, you know, challenged the notion of why we come into a lobby, a reception area, and have to queue up at a reception desk and get a lanyard and then sit in a sofa waiting for something to happen. I mean, what's that about? So we worked with Stuart and the team to challenge what that experience could and should be, and working with Despina, who's part of your team. And the end result is that there is no reception desk or security desk in that lobby. It's more like a hotel. The experience is more like travel, like the airline experience. You get a boarding pass and you can self-serve. You can get into your building or as a visitor, get to the floor and meet the person you're coming to see without this horrendous barrier. So I think we should learn a lot from other industries. I think we should learn around the automation that comes with carrying a cell phone, a mobile phone, which could do a lot for us. And that could interact with the built environment and the infrastructure around us. But also, if you look at retail, they are superb at using data and analytics. They can understand footfall and queue or dwell times. They know their customer. They know who's walking into the store. We have no idea who walks into our reception spaces.
And I get this idea of the frictionless office, I mean, we hear a lot about, which I think is really interesting. And also, I guess you're beginning to touch on productivity because, of course, retailers want all that information because they can relate it directly to sales. The issue in the office is that we haven't collected it probably because we can't relate it to productivity. So why spend the time and the money?
Oh, but I think that's now changing. And I think that's a very exciting paradigm shift. So the technology that actually enabled us to carry on during lockdown was the cloud. You know, almost all of us had our software and services delivered from this fluffy thing called the cloud, which is actually a serious change for the office because the office itself, the building, no longer houses any of our infrastructure. It doesn't house the servers or the software or the processing needed for work. So that's a big psychological shift. But because the cloud delivers and drives our performance, let's say Microsoft 365, that data is now available. And within Microsoft, it's called Viva Insights. So, Michael, let's say you had a team of 1,000 salespeople, and you can measure high performers. They sell the most. They meet their targets. How do they compare to the lower performers, the bottom 5, 10%? What are they doing that's different? So you can look at the strength of their network, the number of emails they send, the time they spend with customers through their calendar. But you can also look at when they come into a building, which building they come into, where they work, who they work with, even how much coffee they drink, or when they leave in the afternoon. So all of these things, which is broadly called telemetry, can now for the first time actually measure productivity.
Which I think is a really interesting point, and one I guess we all businesses need to pick up on, right? And actually start figuring out how productive everyone is. Salespeople probably easier to do than some other parts of the workforce, but as you said, that paradigm shift needs to happen. As part of that, and you mentioned the cloud and you mentioned networks, maybe we just take a step back and think about cities, because obviously office buildings that we've been talking about for a little bit make up CBDs and other parts of cities, but I know you're talking a lot about the idea of nodes and these networks, so maybe explain that a little bit more.
Yes, I mean, look, the classic central business district, which was based on agglomeration, is a dead construct. I mean, we've proven in lockdown that even the most hardened resistance to change, you know, the lawyers, the bankers, have all had to work from home and have been surprisingly effective. You know, billable hours and profit per partner is up, or, you know, traders were able to function, you know, given compliance issues. So what can we think about in terms of the city? Well, we think a polycentric city will emerge, you know, multiple centres in effect, maybe nodes based around transport terminals to kind of minimise distance commuting and so on. We think that the kind of nature of the city itself will move. Richard Florida, who's a great commentator in the States, talks about no longer the central business district, but the central social district. And I know the City of London has begun to think about the idea of a 24-hour activated city. So when you do come in for your 2 or 3 days a week, there's more purpose. You know, there is socialization and an active environment and not something that feels fairly dead and is purposeful only for work.
So is that the idea, if you look at London as the example, that the West End of London is kind of already there in that it has a lot of retail and social, let's say, as well as the offices, whereas the City of London traditionally has been that agglomeration of like-minded bankers, lawyers, insurance. So the cities which have those CBDs, which are single purpose, will need to expand. I guess a bit like Wall Street has done in the US, it's become much more of a place people live and shop as well as work.
Yeah, I mean, you look at financial in Manhattan, and it's a residential environment as much as anything else now, and you've seen the disbursement of the banks. I think we should find a different balance. I think one of the big issues with real estate is that mixed use is very rare in the CBD, and if it's done, it's still done in silos. And I think one of the kind of secrets will be true integrated use. One of the things that I can see happening is that you've got residential above commercial, and therefore you can sweat the asset. You know, what is an auditorium by day for the office workers becomes a cinema by night for residents. What is a commercial kitchen feeding office workers in the day is a commercial kitchen shipping deliveroos to apartments by evening. So, you know, property needs to be reimagined, planning needs to be challenged. And we need to get to the idea of integrated use, I think, to activate our cities.
Which I guess the residential above office doesn't seem too much of a stretch, given that we have office and hotel and retail as a combined use in tower blocks around the world. But it seems to be offices have sort of not been part of that trend. And you're suggesting that if they were, that would add to the vibrancy of the areas around them.
Yeah, there's an absolute blurring. You know, hotels are becoming workplaces and promoting themselves quite heavily as places to work. And we should sweat the asset in a very different way.
In terms of sweating the asset, and talk a little bit about, a lot of people talk about ESG, and we know what that means, but the S part being the difficult part. So do you feel like if buildings become more, let's call it multi-purpose, mixed use, the social part of ESG is going to improve dramatically because they now have to think about the environment that they're in, not just the building itself. So we move from this almost black and white building an area around it to a blending of the two.
I completely agree. I think, you know, the idea of permeability into the sort of public realm will be critical. I think most city office blocks, they might pay some lip service and do pocket parks, but by and large, they're secured at the perimeter. I think some of the best examples globally are where they're permeable. My favourite is National Australia Bank's headquarters in Melbourne, which sits between a railway terminus and a public space like a sports arena. And their entire ground floor plane is public. And people can kind of access it. There are cafes, there's a bank branch, there's training for social media, there's an auditorium that can be used by the community as much as anyone else. And security goes to the first floor. So that what you're doing is encouraging that integration with the community, and I think we should see that much more. That links to experience. I mean, everyone carries on a mobile phone or cell phone, and yet almost it's inert today. You know, that there's no connection between the physical space and the individual.
You talk about You talk about super experience, I think it is, in the book, as opposed to user experience, if I got that right. So, I mean, you just mentioned experience. So is that what you're referring to, this idea that going to an office space is as much about the work you do there as it is what you do in the environment around it?
It is. I mean, we did some interesting research for the developer and property business Mirvac in Australia, and there's a super experience report that we researched for them as part of our WorkTech Academy. And in that, we found some really exciting ideas to activate the precinct, which is the kind of classic term in Australia. And precinct activation is really interesting. I think one of the best examples is Australia Technology Park, which is the Mirvac development in Sydney, which it combines, you know, heritage, historic buildings with a brand new campus, mainly for Commonwealth Bank of Australia, but incredible integration into the community from community parks and creches all the way through to really interesting curation of food and drink, event space, and so on. Now, activation of the precinct means that you have an experience as you come onto the space. And people want experience, and we have the ability to kind of connect with them and also to reconnect with them. How often is that done in property? Almost never.
Just to drill down a bit further, I mean, we've talked about these big trends that are going on and cities and nodes and the networks. If we now think about the office space and everything that you've talked about around it, so there's this almost a dichotomy of personalization versus teaming, which is not an easy thing, and it's maybe back to the chaos of the swan syndrome, you know, what's going on under the water. So on the one hand, we have a lot of people wanting personalization in order to get them back into the office, and yet that's obviously complicated to do. So how do you see that playing out? Are we going to have to try and meet the needs of everyone?
I think you can personalize, or people can perceive a personalized experience. And I think what's interesting to me is that almost every organization has diversity in its corporate values. And when you ask them, why do you have diversity? You know, it's about the benefits of bringing a diverse group together. So that's about cognitive diversity as much as neurodiversity and other aspects. And yet, we park that at the front door of our office buildings. You know, you walk through and it's one size fits all. Yeah. It all looks the same. So you kill the benefits of diversity because you shoehorn people into homogeneity. Now, we can do that differently, Michael, I think. I think we can celebrate true diversity and provide inclusion. I think that you can begin to look at space that suits you based on your psychometric profile, based on what you're trying to do, but more importantly, based on your life stage, which is often ignored. You know, if you are in your 20s and you want to partly have a social experience at the office, there's a certain buzz and energy and vibrancy that you expect when you've come in. If you're in your late 30s and you've got two young kids and you live in a suburban location, you actually want to be there as little as possible, minimize your commute, and typically be productive when you're there and focus on that only. And then perhaps if you look at your kind of empty nesters, those in their 50s, what do you need out of the office? You may want to go out into the kind of social realm afterwards and enjoy leisure. You may want to do something different. So we tend to kind of look at personas, but they're done by job role. They're very narrow and they forget who we are as individuals. So my view is that we need a heterogeneous approach. It's partly personalized, but it's partly celebrating difference and providing choice.
And is that going to be driven by the employee? Because one of the big shifts we've obviously seen is this idea that the employer, and you talk about it in the book, but let's call it the industrialization of the office space, so everything's the same, as you've just said. Now, because of the pandemic and technology, we've all gone, we can actually have a view and a preference. So is this design, let's call it design change, going to be driven by the employee? And if so, kind of how?
I think it's driven from both sides. I mean, let's start with the employer. There's an opportunity here to reduce your real estate footprint. You know, we see it's a flight to quality. So I think it's less space, but better space. And we're seeing organizations ask for 40% reductions in real estate. Now, I know that might be a challenge for the industry, but it's a reality. But we need to build better quality space as a result. I think for the employee, we follow economic cycles, and at the moment, you know, we are in the middle of all sorts of interesting macroeconomic trends. You know, we've gone from last year's great resignation to this year's great regret. You know, we're seeing people, you know, really kind of reimagine actually what life needs to be like. The commute, the idea that actually, you know, a secure job has got some benefits, especially with energy crisis and other recessionary threats coming over the horizon. So I think what we're going to find is that the kind of balance of power will carry on shifting. But the war for talent, I don't think, will go away. And I think, you know, most organizations realize that changing expectations and attracting Gen Z or Gen Z will require a different approach.
And let's talk about that. So the, you know, a lot of people say the design industry has, with hindsight, got it wrong, but which may be a bit harsh. But, you know, we've designed for this industrialization. We've now got to design for a completely different workforce, as you just said, with completely different expectations about what work means. There's this idea that I really like that, you know, businesses are about, obviously about profit, but they're also about purpose. And you started talking about that when you started talking about diversity and being left at the door, which it shouldn't be. You mentioned various things in the book. The first one I wanted to touch on was the D school at Stanford University, because I thought that was fascinating. Can you just elaborate on that a little bit?
Yeah, so look, the D school inhabits this fantastic building on the Stanford campus. And I think what's exciting about that is I would define it as a workplace that can be morphed by the user. So the core D school has this incredible array of gantries where people themselves can rearrange and create the space. Walls can move, everything, every element can be adapted. So I think in terms of a creative space where people come together, you know, most facility managers just like permanence. We need to kind of go for something which is much more fluid. And in the book, we discuss the idea of an elastic workplace. And I think that's what Stanford does quite well. You know, allows people to define their own space for the purpose and the activity at hand. And we're seeing corporates do the same thing. ANZ's famous sandbox in Melbourne began to do the same.
And what about, I guess, the other end of that, or if you pull the elastic far enough, you get to the St. Luke's example that you used, which has been around for a while, actually, interestingly. So nothing to do with the pandemic. But describe that a little bit, because I always love that idea.
Yeah, St. Luke's was a genius space. Andy Law, and we quote Andy's book in Unworking, talks a lot about challenging what the office is for. And it's a creative advertising agency, which at its time was the award-winning agency. And Andy, who ran it, said, you know, let's challenge the office. You know, what is it about these corridors with these endless rooms? What are they for? And he gave his space to his clients and said, look, our clients pay for our office. Let's give them the space. And each key client account had their own themed environment. Boots number 17 for cosmetics, the Eurostar became like a train carriage, and you'd work in a space that was evocative of the problems and opportunities faced by your clients, what you're trying to solve for them. And that was also transformed by the technology of the time. It was one of the first offices in London, certainly, to employ mobile telephony, the idea that you could move around the office and you didn't have a desk phone, so you were anchored back to a desk. And they all carried St. Luke's satchels. There was a chef creating fabulous food and drink. And it was a buzzing, cool place to be. And driven by a chief exec who had vision.
And that's about personalizing the workplace for the type of business that they're in and trying to be different to their competitors. So again, back to this productivity question, how do we compete in a very difficult market? And we can do something with offices for our industry and our people that's different.
And I think it's not just differentiation for our employees, it's for our clients.
Yeah.
You see, I think that's often the kind of biggest opportunity. You know, if most clients come into vanilla meeting rooms, however beautiful they are, however interesting the food and drink is, you know, that by and large, they're the same. And that doesn't differentiate the experience. You know, but when I go to see Amazon in Seattle and they take me into the spheres for a meeting, That's different. That's a workplace, but it's a wow, right? You just go, what an amazing space. And I spoke to a coder on the Alexa team who was sat on his own working, and he said, I do my best work in this environment. And so it doesn't need to be a cube or a desk. You know, you can reimagine what a workplace is. And back to that kind of, you know, mechanization of the office we've been through, Michael, you know, why are all floor plates rectilinear? You know, why do I look at a kind of a floor plan, a space plan, and everything is little boxes? Technology doesn't want boxes. Technology actually would like different geometries of space. And if you, when you get an architect who's brave, one of my favorite buildings is Heatherwick's Learning Hub in Singapore, where there are no right angles. All the classrooms are only curved walls. There's no front and back. There's no right and wrong. So why don't we challenge our architects and spatial designers to be more imaginative and more aligned to what technology really needs?
And just going one level below that, in a way, you talk about Julian Tett's book, the Silo Effect, I think it's called. It seems to me that we've created a new silo, which is working from home. And a lot of people talk about the lack of spontaneity and all the things you've just been talking about. You know, can you get that creativity, let's call it, at home? You can certainly get work done, but is it of a high enough quality? You know, how do you marry that with wanting or needing people to be in an environment which is creative, let's say, or more productive?
I think this, again, it's back to measurement. And we are seeing organizations launch the most amazingly creative workspaces. So let's start with measurement. You know, you can tell the collaboration coefficient of teams and groups through the data from Microsoft. So I could tell you within your organization, these three groups have got this huge collaboration coefficient. They're emailing each other all the time. They're working on shared documents. They've got endless calendar events where they're all coming together for physical or virtual meetings. So you can identify the collaboration coefficient. Let's say there are three groups. You say those people should work together, and those three groups happen to be 115 people. So you know now that you need to accommodate 115 people for a period of time in a creative environment. So you can right-size your workplace for that kind of data-driven, evidence-led approach to workplace and work. But then where do you put them? Do you just book a meeting room? Probably not, right? So Lego has just reopened its Billund headquarters in Denmark, and only a third of it is desking and formal meeting spaces. The majority of that space is about people coming together. So almost the office as off-site, which I think will be a big new trend. And the spaces are remarkable. So it also includes, Michael, a 60-bedroom hotel. People can come and stay at the Lego headquarters for a day or two, have the offsite. There are karaoke bars, restaurants, social spaces, well-being, hobby. You can enjoy yourself there. Likewise, Salesforce has opened Trailblazer Ranch in the Redwoods. Now, where would you want to go for a couple of days with those 115 people for that creativity that's been identified through the data? In a bland meeting room in downtown San Francisco, or in the ranch for 2 or 3 days? I know where I'd choose.
Yeah, and I guess the Lego example is a good one of them, because their headquarters is not quite in the middle of nowhere, but it's not in a city center, let's say. So you've got to attract people. Have got to want to go there or be attracted to it. So hence, presumably, the hotel space. They've gone, the accommodation needs to be really good. If it was in the middle of London, you wouldn't need to bother with that. So it gets back to the personalization in a way.
Well, I challenge that as well. I mean, if you look at Goldman's at 200 West, you know, that includes the Conrad Hotel. Now, I know that they're branded separately, but they're all intertwined in the same building. So when you're in Goldman's, you're socializing in the hotel bar with a lot of Goldman people. And that creates a sense of belonging when you've gone to 200 West. So you may not own the hotel like Lego, but you might want to kind of coexist and find yourself in a development where you can, you know, get the best of both, in a sense, and control or shape the experience you want your people to have.
Am I right in saying then that you, as this evolves, the let's say the best offices are going to be the ones that are focused on the, I call it the profit and the purpose. So what is it that they're trying to do as an organization, which is the St. Luke's example, perhaps? You know, what are they trying to do for their people, which might be the Amazon example in Seattle. So really thinking about space as something that's value creating, as opposed to an empty box or a, you know, is that's the direction of travel that you think our industry should be going in?
I think that's the direction of travel for a certain type of activity, that kind of creative collaboration, which you can identify, measure, and then accommodate. But there are other types of work, right? I mean, you know, you might come in for the day to be, you know, immersed in culture. It might be part of an onboarding or training experience. You might be coming in for, you know, a bit of collaboration work or better technology, and then a need for some solo work as well. You know, the idea of some deep work and getting into a state of flow, which is typically very difficult. I think what you can't now assume is you'll come to an office, you'll sit at a desk, you'll have sporadic Teams or Zoom calls, which are inferior because you've got noise around you and movement, and think, well, why haven't I stayed at home? You know, I've got a better setup at home. And that's a bit that back to life stage, you know, as well as your age and your stage in life. You know, it's what's your setup at home? You know, are you sharing a kitchen table or do you have a study? And I think all these things impact the need and role of the office for each type of individual.
You finish up the book, Philip, talking about the 10 workplaces of the future, and there's a couple I wanted to talk about. And just before I do, I came across this quote, which was from the CEO of Gallup, Jan Clifton. Improving life at work isn't rocket science, but the world is closer to colonizing Mars than it is to fixing the world's broken workplaces. It's quite an extraordinary comment. Two of the workplaces you talk about that I just wanted you to touch on as we wrap up was the sentient one, which we talked a little bit about earlier, and also the consumerized workplace.
So look, I mean, I love Gallup's annual survey. And the frightening thing is that they find that most people in the office are disengaged. They don't want to be there. And that's frightening. After all these years of us talking about workplace and the investments, you know, we're creating spaces that, you know, in North America, the majority of people don't want to be. So it's quite an indictment on the overall industry. So sentient is how we feel. And that's what Gallup's research is measuring. And we're not feeling very good, by and large, at work. I think we felt better at home. You know, we've been able to graze and eat our own food. We've been able to do some chores, but also go for walks and all the things that people value. So let's learn from that. There aren't many great examples. I mean, I love Meta's garden on the roof in Menlo Park. I love Medibank in Melbourne, where they've designed a building based on walking on steps. You don't take the elevator. You really do walk. And that's a simple kind of part of being well, isn't it? It's movement. And we've done a bit of tokenism, standing desks, but actually encouraging walking and movement inside the office. We've tended to minimize circulation as inefficient space. Maybe some of these things need to be reconsidered.
And we talked a little bit about the environment, which is what you're talking about, well-being. We know we've got a big mental health crisis, which is only getting worse, sadly, particularly for the younger generation, who, of course, are growing up through the workforce. And I think some of what you're talking about talks to that. The other thing, and maybe to wrap up on, you talk about the consumerized workplace. So what do you mean by that?
So look, Michael, I think in our day-to-day lives, we are using apps and platforms and we're giving star ratings. You know, we take an Uber ride and we give it a star rating. We stay in a hotel or an Airbnb and we star rate it. And this idea of consumer apps becomes part of workplace thinking. So that's the consumerization. It's a bit more kind of we are consumers of workplace. There's a number of elements to that. You know, the idea of workplace as a service, maybe giving people a stipend or a budget and saying, you know, here, Michael, your budget for workplace is X thousand a year. You can use it in our own offices, but you can also go and use it in a hotel or a co-work or whatever else you want to kind of work that's conducive. But I think more than that, I think when we do come in, we will gamify our experience. So we'll leave this meeting room that we're in today and we'll gamify it. As we leave the door, it'll flip up on our app saying, how was it for this experience? How was the coffee? You know, what was it like? And would others like it? Do you rate it? And therefore, as we choose how, when, and where to work, we'll also look at reviews and star ratings and begin to make our decisions on what others have said. And I think quite soon we'll use machine learning and artificial intelligence as well. So the data will nudge you to say, actually, Michael, this isn't the best place for you to work for this current task. There's a great space five floors up with a view. Why don't you go there instead? And I think all the stuff we do in our personal lives, you know, the blue dots on a Google map showing you where you are and how to get to your destination, we don't have that in the office. Why not? So let's make it a bit more of a consumer experience.
I think that's a really good point, because there is so much technology out there that will be really helpful to solving some of the problems that, that you and I have talked about for years. And now we seem to be in a place where it's going to happen. Philip, as always, great talking to you. As I said, a fascinating book. I love reading it. So congratulations on that, most importantly. I look forward to seeing your workplaces of the future and using all this material. Appreciate you joining me. Thank you.
Thanks, Michael. Really.